Okay, so our next presenter is Linnea Ashley. She's the National Training and Advocacy Manager for Youth Alive, and she will be talking about peer benefits, helping expand a victim compensation program's reach. So welcome, Linnea.
How are you guys doing? You awake? I'm going to change gears a little bit, and so I want to start off with a question. Has anybody ever heard of hospital-based violence intervention programs? I'm excited. So my name is Linnea Ashley, and I work with Youth Alive, and we are a violence prevention and intervention organization. And so among the myriad of things that we do is hospital-based violence intervention. And that means, for those of you who aren't aware, we work with violently injured youth, so people who have been shot or stabbed and present at the hospital, typically the trauma center, but sometimes the emergency room if time permits. And we provide immediate kind of resources right there in the moment. We call it the golden moment. It's when people are tending to be most receptive to receiving outside care from other folks and other resources, and then continue those services from anywhere from 6 to 12 months. We were the first in the nation to be doing this work, and since then it's kind of blossomed, and there are programs all over the country and actually internationally as well. That led to the start of the National Network of Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Programs, which is a mouthful to say the least, but it is a collection of other programs that are doing that work. In Northern California alone, we have 6 different programs that are doing work that's similar to that. And so we recognize the work that we do as being really important, understanding that of the people who have been violently injured, especially being shot, anywhere upwards of 40%+ of those will be shot again in the next 5 years, and 20% of those will be killed. And so that's an older study, but that was just so jarring to us. We recognized what a really vulnerable population it was, and so it recognized how important this work that we do with this population really is. At the same time, we work really closely with victims' compensation programs. And anybody know victims' compensation programs? Most states have them. I think actually all states have them. A lot of people refer to them as VOC, or victims of crime, which is actually the national distinction. But for us, there have been peer counselors that are recognized throughout California's victims' compensation program, where they can be reimbursed for either their volunteer or for their time, because it's seen as something very valuable that a peer can offer resources that maybe a professional can't, or that person doesn't want to access in that particular way. However, in California, up until very recently, the only kind of peer counselors that were recognized were for intimate partner violence and sexual violence, so rape counselors. And even though we do very similar services and require very similar training for our professionals, that's not something that could be reimbursed, and so this is where our legislation came from. So today I want to talk to you a little bit about AB 1629, the partnership and the process, and then where that legislation is right now. So because we had done some research looking at these other peer counselors that were able to be reimbursed and recognizing similarity in what we were doing, we decided we wanted to try and mirror that legislation in California to see if we could get our peer counselors recognized. We call them intervention specialists, but essentially it's the same concept. People who understand where this person's, the person who's experiencing this particular ailment is coming from, intense training, and then ongoing services as necessary. We had legislation that we've kind of mocked up and mirrored to the existing legislation, and we got lucky. Assemblymember Bonta, who was kind of new at the time, was very excited to ask us what he could carry, and so he carried it for us, and we were one of the sponsors for the bill, and we were really actually surprised at getting bipartisan support all the way through, so both houses. And that was very surprising to us. So that part was a little bit easier than we anticipated, but it was a bit of a learning curve in terms of what we learned going through the process. So we establishing a relationship with CalVCP, which is our governing body, or VCCGB, we've got lots of acronyms. who are the people who actually manage our victims compensation program. There's a board that's responsible for it, has been really important, and part of it has done kind of backwards, and so one of the learnings we had was to do it kind of in reverse for future reference, but really kind of making, having a real relationship with CalVCP in terms of what does it require, what do they need, what does it look like, what does the actual implementation of the legislation look like, and then really communication about what the needs are, both on our end and on their end. It's proved to be really successful for us, kind of on the back way, because there are some other questions we have about the work that we do and how we interact with CalVCP, and so has kind of having this emerging relationship has been helpful in that way. But also about expectations and managing what the expectations are, both for the work that we do and what their expectations are from us, and also what our expectations are from them and what they are capable of doing. So AB 1629, what it actually landed on after it passed was it's a very specific set of rules about the amount of time that someone has to be trained, what they have to be trained on, and then also what the reimbursement process looks like, what makes someone eligible for reimbursement. For us, it seemed like a really good match, and we wanted to go this route because whenever someone is violently injured and we're working with them, one of the first things we do is have them fill out their CalVCP paperwork in the first place to see what they're eligible for, so whether it be anything from relocation, if there's medical bills that can be taken care of, if there's mental health services that can be provided. And so this is kind of swaddled in with mental health services. We thought it was really important, especially because with the population that we work with, largely male between the ages of 12 and 24, also largely Latino and Black, there can often be stigma associated with mental health services. We also found that there can be limitations in terms of people's the caregivers, their comfort level themselves with providing services for the types of injuries and the types of experiences that the young people that we work with have dealt with, and so there can be some clashes in that way. And so one of the benefits of peer counseling is that the folks that are offering the counseling are people that they can relate to and are open to speaking to, even if it's not in a directly clinical way. And so that was something that was really beneficial on that end. What we've learned from putting this together is that it's very specific, the letter of the law, and so what CalVCP can do is, all they can do is what is actually written in the law, and so there was some language that is very specific and was kind of binding. One of the pieces of AB 1629 that we had, so once it passed, it was actually had an automatic sunset. So instead of it going indefinitely, it will actually end. It's been in effect for a year now, and it will end in another year. And that gave an opportunity for us to see like how successful it was. And so we'll have to put it back up at the beginning of this year, hopefully for it to have a non-expiring deadline. And so the benefit of that has been that because we've seen some of the limitations and some of the mistakes that we made in the creation of the law in the first place, it gives us an opportunity to kind of tweak that a little bit and move it forward. One of the other benefits of putting this together is that we made a requirement for 40-hour training, which required us to create a curriculum, which is what has taken us a very long time to do, but we're nearing the end of that process. We really like that because it means that if other people are looking to be reimbursed using this legislation, it requires that they have actually undergone the training that we think is most important for peer counselors to undergo in order for them to be able to work with this very vulnerable population. And so that's really positive for us. It also proves to be really positive for us because, like I mentioned before, as part of the national network, we have programs that are all over the country and actually going internationally. And one of the things we've really been looking at is how can we professionalize the work that we do and have it recognized in other places. And this is a way for us to kind of have a universal understanding of these are the basics that anybody who's doing this type of work would be certified in doing. And so that's a really important piece that's come out of this as well. tangentially kind of related to what I was just saying is we recently got, we being the National Network of Hospital-Based Violence Intervention Programs, got the National Uniforms Claims Committee to officially recognize professional, like prevention professionals. They didn't do specifically a violence prevention professional, but they left it kind of vague so that there can be different types of prevention professionals. And the reason this is important is because it allows for there to actually be a code starting in April to be an actual code for this type of work, because one of the difficulties we've found with hospitals and so and other agencies like kind of taking on this work and really seeing the value in it is that they have no way to bill for it, and this will provide an avenue for billing for it. This ties in with the AB 1629, as I mentioned, because we have been working on this curriculum, which would be required for certification, which then ties into the need to be able to professionalize and be attached to this taxonomic code, and so that's been a really important thing as well. So up till this point, we have only trained our organization, but in once we get the certification on the actual curriculum, which should be coming sometime in the next month, the plan is to do kind of a rollout of training for other programs. As I mentioned, we have six just in Northern California. We have also have one in LA. And so to get as many people trained on this to start billing so we can actually see what that looks like in real life. It's been a really interesting piece, but we really think it's important because it's such a hyper-vulnerable population of people who have been violently injured, to make sure that they have the resources that are necessary for them to do healing, make sure that it's done with a trauma-informed lens, and make sure that it's done with people who really can understand what it is that they're going through. It doesn't mean that it's something separate from mental health services, so if people are open and want to receive mental, like more formal clinical mental health services, that doesn't preclude them from receiving those services as well, but it does provide them another opportunity. Oh no, yes. does anybody have any questions?
So how do you select the peers?
That depends on the program. So this, we won't be able to dictate program to program. We just now know that if you're going to be claiming that you're doing this work, that you have to have gone through the certification process. For us individually at Youth Alive, we have someone on staff, our manager for our Caught in the Crossfire program, which is the one that is a hospital-based violence intervention program, and she's been on staff 13, 14 years, and she just has kind of an eye for it. For us, we look at, you don't have to have been, you don't have to be the victim, and you don't have to necessarily have been a perpetrator of violence, but to have some kind of close proximity to violence in your life has been really helpful. I timed myself. We look for people who definitely are empathetic, not necessarily sympathetic, but we're looking for empathy, we're looking for kind of an understanding and somebody that young people are able to relate to. We have actually, for us, part of the reason we're hospital-linked versus hospital-based, programs are staffed through the hospital itself, and because we're hospital-linked, we have a little more wiggle room in terms of who we can hire. We don't have the same kind of restrictions on that, and so there's just kind of some variation in that. That's all. SF Wraparound.
Oh, great. but I found that I only got the patients that were now adults and suffering from chronic illness and having such bad mental health at this point, their management was so challenging. And if we could have gotten them while they were youth, it would have been amazing to get them connected. Is there any component of the program that connects them with the primary provider to keep track of them and ensure they stay connected?
That's starting to happen a little more, especially with Obamacare, because now people are having access to services. We've found, so this links with some other research that I've been doing, but looking at a lot of young men especially don't seek services, period. And so unless it's something like really catastrophic, and so that's often where we get the hands on them. But we did a focus group related to a different project, and one of the young men actually had a primary care physician, and he sang the praises of having one. And it was interesting to have him be that voice rather than it coming from us. And so a lot of the young men were kind of listening to him talk about how neat it was, how much faster he got to be seen, how this person remembered who he was and what else was going on. And so it is something that we attempt, just because we're doing one-on-one services with our wraparound services, to try and ease them through the process of being seen, but getting them to go to the hospital other than when they have like an acute illness is often really something that we struggle with as well. And then I just kind of wanted to piggyback really quickly off of also in terms of reaching people beforehand. We've been doing research kind of tangential to this, but we have something called START, which is the screening and tool for the assessment and relief of trauma. And the idea was because we work with people who are violently, like have already been injured in this very direct way, but a lot of people have suffered from like trauma of some sort, whether it be the neighborhoods that they live in or the houses that they're in or what have you. And they often have symptoms and they may not actually have been be exhibiting in a really public way yet, but it's still hampering their quality of life. And so was there something we could do for those? Also recognizing that especially with young men of color, young men period, that they're the least likely to access services. And so this is something that you can do. It's based off of ESPERT, screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment, which was used, initially it was used for alcohol use, and so it was like universal screening in emergency rooms because so many people who present have something that's related to alcohol. And the idea is to kind of look at who is, is your drinking, like your drinking habits are right on time, keep doing that. If they're kind of borderline, hey, let's talk about what some of the dangers are, and if it's really dangerous, to go ahead and refer them to other services. And so we were thinking of doing the same thing for trauma, and so we have this pilot that we're working on right now based on a lot of research that we've done, and that the same thing is true for trauma. And so instead of looking at a clinical diagnosis, it's about looking at trauma symptoms themselves, and so it's non-clinical, anybody can use it, and then providing things that have already been established as tools and interventions that can be helpful for like grounding and focus and sleep, and then just psychoeducation in general, and can be done in 30 minutes. And so if anybody's interested in that, I can definitely talk to you about that because we're looking for places to pilot. START, screening and tool for the assessment and relief of trauma.
Great, let's thank Linnea.
So we have about 8 minutes of time for additional questions for any of our panelists. Does anybody have any questions they'd like to ask? Okay, I want to ask one to Linnea. So crafting and developing legislation seems like a really lofty, difficult task. Do you have any tips for any of us that are thinking of doing the same thing? I mean, how much effort is it, but what are like 3 or 4 key points that we need to consider?
Pay a lot of attention. So to start with, to find somebody on whoever's going to be carrying that legislation, you want to look for a really strong partner who's used to doing that, who's also really gung-ho. Sometimes legislators carry a lot of different legislation, and so they have kind of pet projects, and so you want someone who has yours kind of as a main one, so they'll pay some attention. And then to make friends with whoever their specific person is for legislation, that kind of type of legislation. So for us, it's Amy Halley, and we were best buds, and I talked to her a lot, and she called me a lot. So that's another piece that I would say. And then pay really close attention to the language that you use, because one of the things we weren't clear on was that exactly what's written in legislation is exactly how it has to be executed. There is no wiggle room. So what we were told retrospectively is to be as vague as you need to be in places where you're not sure, and to be as specific as you need to be in the things that you really want to make sure that's the case. So that was one of the things. We have like some interesting like titles of like what the training pieces were going to be called, because we just kind of pulled it together, and the names themselves aren't really that important, but it's now a requirement for us to have that integrated into the curriculum, because that's how it's written in there. And then also, like I said, anybody who you think that might be against you or who could be an ally, you really want to have really strong conversations with them before you actually kind of start building it, because you want to know if they're against, if they potentially against you, like what is it about it? Sometimes it's something really simple that you might be able to incorporate and be able to fix before you ever get to the point of them having to come out vocally against you. And if it's not, it's just good for you to know in advance who might not be on board and who might be coming out against you. And then for the folks that are potentially your fans, you want to make sure you're not undercutting anybody else, that there's not something else that's already in the works or another way. What we also learned from Cal VCP was if there's a way for you to do it that's not legislation, that's often an easier task to undertake than going through legislation. And so you want to talk to whatever agencies might be involved in case it's possible for you to do it administratively speaking rather than having to go through the all-out, you know, legislative process.
Great. Any other questions? Okay. Well, with that, I will close this session. I want to encourage all of you to go online and evaluate the session using the mobile app that APHA has provided so they can improve the quality of the meeting. And I want another round of applause for all our presenters.